Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama stepped up to the White House lectern last night and took another big swing at one of America's thorniest problems, our sprawling, expensive, complicated, inefficient, inequitable health care system. If negotiating with insurance companies, drug makers, doctors, and Congress is tough, so is explaining what's on the drawing board to the American people.
I realize that with all the charges and criticisms that are being thrown around in Washington, a lot of Americans may be wondering, what's in this for me? How does my family stand to benefit from health insurance reform? So tonight I want to answer those questions.
And then he waded in, wading in again today in Cleveland at the Cleveland Clinic on the reform push. Critics say it's too much and it's not enough. Supporters say we must do what can be done right now. This hour, On Point, the great healthcare debate in Washington, what's on the table, and what could soon be law. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to hit the change button on healthcare? Is Washington crafting the change we need? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington is Cece Conley, who covers healthcare for The Washington Post and who has been following all the work and debate on Capitol Hill. Cece Conley, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So what's the president up against? Why did he come out so prominently last night to do what, Cece?
Well, the president's goals last night were to really speak to two different audiences simultaneously. One was the 535 members of Congress, especially Democrats in his own party, who have gotten a little bit stalled in the effort on Capitol Hill. The other important audience is the public, average Americans, who we are learning from a number of polls right now, while they agree that there are some real problems in our healthcare system and they'd like to see some changes, they're also very anxious about what the effect of those changes may be. In particular, what struck me about Obama's comments last night, because he really didn't say anything terribly new, but he was very targeted toward the middle class and the 180 million people in this country who have health insurance today. He needs for that audience to think that this whole big, dramatic overhaul is going to be worth it to them personally.
What was his message to them? What case did he make to that politically very influential, huge body?
Well, again, not a terribly new case if you're consumed with this the way that you and I might be, but for the general public, what he is trying to say is, number one, if you like what you've got, I'm not going to mess with it. You still get to pick your doctor. You can stay in the insurance plan that you can stay in, except that I'm going to try to make it a more modern system. I'm going to try to move us towards electronic medical records. I'm going to try to make it so that doctors and patients have the most current evidence on what treatments work the best. And if you don't have insurance, then Obama is saying, I'm going to bring you into the system. That's his overall message.
And can you explain, Cece? I was thinking of those people who may not pay attention to this all the time, listening last night. I'm not sure they would come away, even at the end of that hour, really understanding the most likely change likely to come off of out of Congress here. Can you?
Well, you know, if I had had a chance to ask a question, that was what I wanted to ask. Just for the average American sitting out there, how would their life and their health care experience change? We've already talked about electronic medical records.
Mm-hmm.
I think people would begin, I think they will see that anyway, because we've already seen
stimulus money going to
stimulus
that.
Stimulus money mm-hmm. going toward that. So that is something that we'll see happening.
What else?
I think that it will take a while to really notice and experience dramatic changes, because a lot of it is going to be happening in the way in which doctors and hospitals try to provide care. We know that right now it's very illogical, it's very disorganized, so much of the effort here is getting doctors and nurses and hospitals to work as a team, to be coordinated so that you don't have to run around to several different doctors, so that your record is all in one place. Really getting much better evidence on what works. We know that in this country today, millions, if not billions of dollars are spent on unproven therapies, are spent on unnecessary extra tests. So these are the sorts of things that that he hopes can be tackled.
And what about the way people get care? For the uninsured, are they going to be, does it seem likely they'll be required to buy insurance, as is already the case in Massachusetts?
Yes, and that is something that has not gotten a whole lot of attention. I wrote something about the individual mandate, as it is called, mm-hmm. earlier this week, and it's really quite dramatic because it will be a real sea change in this country. Proponents say two things. It's like car insurance. If you drive a car, you need to have some insurance. But more importantly, there is the whole goal of, it sounds terribly wonky and boring and eyes glaze over, but risk adjustment. And when you're thinking about insurance, you want to spread the risk. So if we can bring more people into the pool, especially a lot of those young, healthy Americans who don't have insurance, they're sometimes known as the invincible.
Yep.
Because they think
they don't think they need it,
sick
mm-hmm.
and nothing's ever going to happen.
Right.
Well, if you bring them into the insurance pool, it is widely believed that that will also help bring down costs for all of us.
And finally,
spreads the risk.
Obviously. And what about this public option? What is that? What would that mean? Public option for whom?
Again, this is another area that has not been very well defined, I think in this case intentionally not well defined, because Congress is really wrangling with several different ways that you could approach it. Essentially, what we hear from President Obama on this subject is that he'd like to set up some sort of government-sponsored, nonprofit health insurance program that would compete with the big for-profits.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses all the time phrases like, to keep the insurance companies honest, to take the profit motive out of health insurance. Now, I can tell you that there are many people that hear this conversation, and they think, well, that's heading in the direction of a European-style, single-payer, government-run system. Right now, Democrats say, no, that's not really what we mean, but that's very much the debate that's taking place on that issue.
Cece, where does this stand, then, on Capitol Hill? You've got the House looking at it. You've got the Senate looking at it. Is it clear what's going to come out and when, at least in broad outline, or not even that yet?
It's not entirely clear what's going to come out, but they're certainly making progress. We saw a bill approved by the Senate Health Committee, but that's a very liberal panel that voted on straight party lines, so we have to kind of keep that in perspective. Over in the House, two committees approved their version of a bill, but the third very important committee, called Energy and Commerce, mm-hmm. is really stuck. There are a couple of sort of mini uprisings going on in that House Democratic caucus right now. As you can imagine, it's a very diverse group of Democrats in the House, and they have very different interests. Some are bigger deficit hawks. Some are urban liberals who want more money for their cities. You've got all kinds of competing pressures, and it's all being haggled and wrangled right now in that committee. The most important place I would suggest to keep an eye on in the coming days and weeks is the Senate Finance Committee. That's chaired by a gentleman named Max Baucus
yep.
from Montana, kind of a moderate Democrat who is working very hard to try to get a bipartisan agreement out of his committee. If he can pull that off, and he hasn't yet been able to, but if he can pick up some Republican senators on his version of the bill and they move that to the Senate floor, I think that will be the most promising bill to watch and to see how it gets shaped, because the president would very much like to have a few Republican votes. He doesn't expect many.
Nope.
But a few would be valuable to him.
he's not going to get what he wanted by the August recess. August 8th, it appears pretty obvious by now. What's the buzz in Washington, CC? Is he going to get reform at all? What's the betting right now?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm certainly not a betting person.
No, not you.
Maybe
but
25 cents or something like that.
But you're listening. What are people saying? He's probably going to get it. He probably won't get it.
I think that there is still a sense that the president has a good chance of seeing some sort of legislation on health care reform enacted this year. How enormous it will be, how significant it will be, how many uninsured people it will cover yet is very much up for grabs. But I think that there is consensus that has built around insurance market reform. I think that there is consensus built around squeezing some waste out of the system, around trying to cover more low-income Americans. So while it seems as if things are kind of stalled right now, there's still a long way to go in this process. Not many people remember, but the Clintons actually fought this out for well over a year. In the end, they were not successful. And I think part of the reason that President Obama is trying to set these very ambitious timetables is that he doesn't want it to drag out that long. But there's still plenty of time.
Plenty of time, but Republicans digging in their heels saying, we don't want this, and if we can stop Obama on this, it will be his Waterloo, Jim DeMint, Senator of South Carolina, said. It will break him. Obama responding to that last night. Did you see, what did you see in the president's eyes last night, Cece?
Well, what strikes me about President Obama at moments like that, and just from reporting on him a little bit now, is he can be quite steely, and I thought I saw that in his rebuttal to Senator Jim DeMint and some of the Republican strategy memos that are starting to come out suggesting that there's at least one whole wing of the Republican Party that is arguing for stall to death.
We're going to come back and dive into the whole picture. Cece Conley with The Washington Post, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great health care debate in Washington. We're going to hear from a supporter of the president's effort in this hour, from a congressman in the middle of it, Republican, who says it's too much, going to cost too much, and from a critic who says it's not going to do enough. Last night, the president laid out a nightmare scenario that health coverage would break the national bank and make Americans less healthy. And then he said that's exactly what we're headed to with what we have now.
If somebody told you that there is a plan out there that is guaranteed to double your health care costs over the next 10 years, that's guaranteed to result in more Americans losing their health care, and that is by far the biggest contributor to our federal deficit, I think most people would be opposed to that. Well, that's the status quo.
That's what we've got, said the president. Joining me now from the House of Representatives, Rayburn Building, is Congressman Michael Burgess, Republican from Texas 26th District. He is a member of the Health Subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, where some of the toughest haggling is going on right now over health care reform. He was for 25 years a practicing obstetrician before joining Congress in 2003. Congressman Burgess, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you. I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
And I know we've just got you for a few minutes, but what do you make of the president's push? Is he pushing for the right thing? And if not, I know you're opposed. Why not?
Well, now, you know, we started through this the beginning of the year, but the reality is the debate started during the presidential debate last year. So I've watched it for some time. I, in fact, was a part of it on the opposite side last fall during the campaign. I've read a lot of speeches. I've read a lot of press reports. I'll tell you, there are places where the president and I actually agree on a number of things. And really, one of the tragedies in this whole Orwellian drama that's playing out in front of us is that I would not necessarily have been a no vote. I was not a default no vote at the end of the process. I don't know that I could have voted with the Democrats on this. But I do know they never tried. They never once asked an opinion. And I presented myself to the chairman of my committee early in the year and said, look, I came from a medical family. I've been in a medical career. It's essentially been my entire life. I didn't come here to sit on the sidelines when we did this legislation. I'll be happy to be involved in the process.
Okay, so fair enough on process. But on the merits, where do you stand? What's your biggest objection? You're clearly in the no camp right now. Why?
Well, let's concentrate there on the areas of agreement, though. I don't think there's any question that Americans with a pre-existing condition that want to be able to have health insurance should be able to find a company that's affordable that will cover them. I want low-income families to have the assistance they need to be able to find to get and purchase a plan that fits them best. I want Americans worried that if they lose their job, they'll be able to carry their insurance with them in that period between jobs and not fall into the ranks of the uninsured.
So why aren't you a yes vote?
Look at what we have to – where do we have to go on the Democrats' position to get those things? I don't agree with the president that giving the government the control is going to be the answer. And certainly giving the government more control over the dollars, the president described a nightmare scenario of doubling. Well, quite honestly, if you look at the Congressional Budget Office, the Democrats' Congressional Budget Office projections, we might triple the expenses and still not cover everyone who's not covered. I certainly don't think that raising taxes on part of the country to pay for health care on another part is necessarily the way to go.
Not and even look, on millionaire what, families after the
Here's the real part of the problem mm-hmm. when you get to utilization. Right now, with the third-party payment system that has been the norm, everyone is anesthetized as to what their care costs them. No one budgets for what it actually costs to have their care any longer. When I was a doctor, if I recommended a test or procedure, the next thing out of someone's mouth was not, well, doctor, is it necessary or are there side effects or risk? The first question was, well, does insurance cover it? Because if insurance covers it, then, of course, I'm going to have the test or the procedure done. No one thinks about the cost of health care. And unfortunately, if we go in the direction the Democrats want us to go, no one is still going to think about the cost of health care.
And the status quo, the president says the status quo will sink us.
No, the president, that's nonsense when the president says it, and he knows it. Well, a better approach would be to get the patient more involved in the decisions that they make and more involved in their health care expenditures. I have a health savings account. I had a medical savings account when they first came along. I think about the money that's being spent in my health care because I'm the one that's writing the check. If we put the purchasing power in the hands of the individuals, now call it what you want, tax credit, voucher, what have you, a pre-fundable or advanceable tax credit. If you put the purchasing power in the hands of the patient and let the patient or the doctor negotiate directly with what will be the best interest of the patient for their treatment plan or their diagnostic plan, you're going to get a better utilization of resources. There is nothing in the Democrats' bill. The Congressional Budget Office said this. There is nothing in the bill that controls volume. And if you don't control for volume, you haven't controlled costs. The way to control volume is to put the purchasing power back in the hands of the patient, let the patient and doctor make the best decisions, and I promise you the costs will come down if you will follow that model. It does every time it's tried.
Congressman Michael Burgess of Texas, thank you very much for joining us today. We'll be following you on this issue. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, sir.
Let me go right now to New York. And Jonathan Oberlander, he's author of The Political Life of Medicare, teaches social medicine, health policy, and management at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Jonathan Oberlander, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
You've got critics on both sides of this plan, but you're saying let's do it anyway. It may, you know, there are questions that it may be too costly. There are questions that it may not do enough to fix the problems we've got. You're saying, no, okay, but let's do it anyway. Why?
I don't think we can afford to lose this opportunity. The chance to enact comprehensive health reform comes around historically once a generation. And when we lose that chance, as we did in 1993 with the Clinton administration, we pay a terrible price in terms of rising costs, growing number of uninsured, and so forth. And so I believe the president is right. The status quo is unacceptable. This is by no means perfect reform, but it would be a major step forward for the country.
I want to get a conversation going here, right now. Also with me in the studio is Dr. Steffi Wollhandler. She's co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program, a practicing physician, herself associate professor of medicine at Harvard, co-director of the Harvard Medical School General Internal Medicine Fellowship Program. Dr. Wollhandler, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You say it's just not enough change.
It's the wrong change, and it's not going to cover the uninsured. It's not going to be affordable, and it's not going to make health care affordable for the American people. The problem with the plan is that the private health insurance industry has been left in the middle of health care, and as long as they're in the middle of things, universal health care is not affordable, and the insurance policies available to middle-class families are going to come with co-payments, deductibles, and gaps that makes care unaffordable to them. And that's, of course, what we've seen in Massachusetts. Our insurance industry pushed for a bill very similar to what they're proposing in Washington, including an individual mandate which forces uninsured people to go out and buy the—
You must buy.
You must buy the defective mm-hmm. products of private insurance companies. The private insurance companies love the Massachusetts reform, but we're finding that one-sixth of all insured people in the state say they can't afford health care. So this is not a solution and is nothing that we should be doing at a national
level. A lot of
level.
People say, but oh, maybe it's not perfect, but don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Something needs to be done here, Dr. Wilhelm.
Something needs to be done, but what we need to be going to is a single-payer system, because the way a single-payer works is you can pay for the whole thing out of the savings on administration.
That is a government-run health care system.
It's a Medicare for all, mm-hmm. Canadian-style system. They mm-hmm. also have single-payer systems in much of Western Europe. And what you have is this single public payer like Social Security that allows you to save a tremendous amount of money on insurance overhead. It means doctors and hospitals don't have to send complicated bills. They save on overhead. You save about $40 billion annually on administrative costs. You don't take that out of the healthcare system, but you use that to cover the 47 million uninsured and to plug the gaps in coverage for insured people. That's the way you get to universal coverage that people can afford, not by doing what the private insurance industry says is their main demand, which is individual mandate, leaving them in the middle, and then going around taxing people to try to pay for it.
Jonathan Oberlander, what do you say to progressive critics like Steffi Woolhandler, who say anything that leaves private insurance in the middle of American health care will not get it done? In fact, you know, this is worse than doing nothing, she's practically saying.
I share Dr. Woolhandler's view that there's a lot wrong with the private insurance industry in the United States. And there's no doubt that a single-payer system has many advantages, cost advantages. It's more efficient. It's more equitable, both over the current system and what's being proposed. But single-payer is not politically feasible. It is not being supported by the president. It's not supported by the congressional leadership. So the question is not, are we going to enact single-payer this year? The question is, are we going to enact a bill that provides many, though not all, Americans with health insurance, reduce the number of uninsured, regulate the private insurance industry in some very important ways? And is that exactly what I want? No. But if we can't get what we want, we have to ask whether an all-or-nothing strategy is really the way to go. And what a lot of single-payer advocates are saying is all-or-nothing, either single-payer or nothing.
The president last night saying what we have now is unsustainable.
If we do not control these costs, we will not be able to control our deficit. If we do not reform health care, your premiums and out-of-pocket costs will continue to skyrocket. If we don't act, 14,000 Americans will continue to lose their health insurance every single day. These are the consequences of inaction. These are the stakes of the debate that we're having right now.
Let's go to Kim in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Kim, you're on the air. What do you see?
Taking my call.
Yes, ma'am.
When I was working, I had a really good health insurance program. My husband and I were both able to be covered at a reasonable rate. Since then, I've lost my job. My husband can't afford to put both of us on the insurance, but he pays for just himself was more than I paid for both of us on my old program. It doesn't cover really well. It's one of those where you either stay healthy or you have a catastrophic illness. There's no middle ground. Any middle ground is going to bankrupt us. We really need a single payer option, or we need a public option. We need to get the insurance companies out of making all these record profits like the oil companies and let us all be covered. It's a moral issue to me.
Kim, let me get both of my guests on this. Jonathan Oberlander, first to you. Would Barack Obama's push help Kim and her husband or not?
Yes, it would. Kim and too many millions of Americans are falling through the cracks of our system right now. And if you work and you don't get insurance from your employer or you don't work, at the moment you have a very difficult time accessing affordable health insurance. And what the reforms would do is two things. One, they would create an insurance exchange, which is a regulated marketplace for private insurers, and you could choose a private insurance plan from that marketplace, and they would be regulated so they couldn't turn you away if you had a pre-existing condition and so forth. And second, the House bill would create, which I think is very important, and the caller mentioned, a new public plan modeled after Medicare. And the uninsured and folks in small businesses and the self-employed could choose to go into that insurance exchange and select a public plan.
Steffi Woolhandler, you heard Kim's situation. Lost the job, lost the coverage, doesn't see a good option. She's with you. She wants universal. But Jonathan says, well, she would be helped by what's being proposed right now in Washington.
Well, probably not. People like her are not being helped here in the state of Massachusetts, where we've got this model.
Why not?
Well, you know, I want to talk just a little about the public plan option, which is going to be a bit of a bait and switch.
Now, hang on a second. Just so I understand, what Jonathan pointed to was not the public option, but this insurance exchange where private insurers would be required to essentially take her on board, insure them.
Well, he, in fact, pointed to both, but we do have an exchange here in Massachusetts, and there's a regulated product that obeys all the rules okayed by the state. Mm-hmm. The cheapest product available to me as a 50-something person would cost me $5,000 in premium. But that comes with a $2,000 deductible, so if I got sick, I have to take another $2,000 out of my pocket.
Even if you're unemployed?
Well, no, if you earn like $33,000
a
year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
No, not if you earn zero. You can get Medicaid in that case. But $33,000 a year, I would have to pay $5,000 in premiums, $2,000 in deductible if I got sick, 20% of all medical costs added up to there. After that, until I got up to $10,000 in covered services, after that, I'd just have to pay for the uncovered services.
Now, that's Massachusetts.
$10,000 a year.
That's a lot. That's maybe too much for somebody like Kim, but is that what's being proposed in Washington?
Oh, absolutely. If you read the House bill, it's modeled very, very closely after Massachusetts, and it's written in what may be Greek to some people in terms of a 72% actuarial value and 65%. But if you work through the examples, they're proposing something virtually identical to what we have in Massachusetts. The regulated, approved product through the insurance exchange is going to cost you $10,000 a year in covered expenses if you get sick. And if you have something like diabetes, you might need $10,000 this year, $10,000 next year, $10,000 the third year, obviously enough to send you into medical bankruptcy. And if you don't believe me, go on the Massachusetts State Connector website and try to get a policy for a 56-year-old person.
Jonathan, that sounds, as Dr. Woolhandler describes it, like a solution that's not a solution.
Well, first of all, I think the characterization of Massachusetts is a bit too negative. It's quite true that the Massachusetts health reforms have very real limits, and including very real benefit limits. And I wish the benefits were more generous and the subsidies were more generous. But we should also point out that Massachusetts has covered an enormous amount of folks who do not have health insurance in a very short period of time. So it's very much a mixed story up there, but they really have improved access. The amount of subsidies that are going to be in this bill coming out of Washington is crucially important. Dr. Woolhandler is right about that, and we need to fight to make sure that those subsidies are as generous as possible so that folks like Kim can have insurance. But the fact of the matter is, tens of millions of uninsured Americans right now have nowhere to go and no subsidies at all to get health insurance. So the fact that these subsidies don't quite measure up to what we want them doesn't mean then they're not better than the status quo. This would be if we pass something like the House bill, it would be a dramatic improvement over the status quo in this country.
And Congressman Burgess saying earlier, well, maybe, but if you don't control costs more effectively than he sees in this work, those costs are going to go out of control. You'll sink the budget, the federal budget that way.
Well, I thought Congressman Burgess was quite thoughtful on a number of points. I think he's wrong about how to control costs. What Congressman Burgess wants to do, although he didn't put it this way, is tax sick people. Because when he talks about increasing co-payments for folks who use medical care. What that means is sicker patients with chronic diseases are going to end up paying more and more. And so I think that is, you know, quite simply the wrong way to go. And honestly, and a lot of us experience this as patients, when we're sick and when we're ill or when we have a loved one who is ill, we're in no position to shop around for the cheapest medical care. It's just a place where regular market forces don't work.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the great healthcare debate going on right now in Washington and what is on the table there in the various House and Senate committees that could soon, one way or another, be law, be affecting every American's healthcare. I've been joined in the studio by Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program, a practicing physician. She wants universal health care coverage, a single-payer program. That's not on the table here. She says this is, in a way, worse than no change. Jonathan Oberlander is with us from New York, teaches social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, joins us from New York City today. Let's hear from our listeners. A lot of them are lining up here. Angelo in Hamden, Connecticut. You're on the air, Angelo.
Hi, Tom. I have a question. Mm-hmm. How are prices determined in the American healthcare system? In other words, who decides how much a patient pays for a procedure such as a hip replacement or an appendectomy? From what I can see, the prices for procedures in the United States are the highest in the world. The third-party payment system has not worked in controlling costs. Now, if Milton Friedman were alive today, he would probably point out that without market competition in healthcare, prices will continually rise. We need more doctors and clinics competing in a healthcare market to drive down costs. Otherwise, the cost of procedures will just continually rise.
But we've got a lot of doctors and a lot of clinics, and that hasn't kept costs down in this country, Angelo, has it?
No competition among them. Do you see doctors advertising procedures at discounted prices? Most patients don't even know how much they're paying for the procedures that they're having done.
Appendectomies, one day only, $49.95. Let us pick it up. Cost control. It's a very important point. Jonathan, first to you, where do you see the cost control dynamic in what it may be coming together on Capitol Hill? Is it there?
I think one of the Achilles heel, maybe the central one of the legislation in Congress right now, is cost control. I think it does not have reliable cost control, and that's because politically it's very difficult to do. The caller is right that the United States does have the highest prices in the world for many medical procedures, but that's not because we have too little competition. In fact, we have, in a way, too much competition. We have much more competition and a much larger role for for-profit private insurers than Canada or Japan or countries in Europe. So the question is, can we do something about regulating prices, not can we create more competition?
And Steffi, do you see some regulation of prices in this? And I can't say this proposal because several things are still on the table, but in what's collectively emerging here?
Well, I believe that there should be free choice for consumers, but they need to have free choice of doctors like you have in Canada and other countries with single payer. You can go to any doctor or hospital you want. What's really bad is competition among insurance companies, which we don't need, because insurance companies compete to not give care. They compete to enroll healthy people and not give them any care. It's really insurance competition is a race to the bottom.
That's best for the bottom line, obviously.
Yeah, but that's a race to the bottom, and that's part of the reason the public plan option won't work. I do want to point out the public plan option is not even going to be introduced in the House bill until 2013.
Now, why are private insurance companies the reason that a public option wouldn't work?
Well, the public, okay, if we were really going to just let people into Medicare, that'd be one thing. But that's not the public plan option that's on the table right now. It's a bit of a bait and switch. They're saying the public plan option would be available in 2013, and it would have to play by all the same rules and regulations as private insurance. Of course, the private insurance insurers are going to compete by trying to enroll all the healthy people and not pay for care. If the public plan option didn't play that same game, they would be saddled with all the sickest patients. Their premiums would go way up to pay for care, and they'd be pushed out. So competition is not the answer in health insurance, and even a competing public option is not going to help. What we really need is a Medicare for All program that doesn't compete, and that's how you get the administrative savings and get everyone covered.
Jonathan Oberlander, where do you see the cost control dynamic in what's on the table now? Steffi Wohlhandler says public option won't do it, having it in the mix.
Right. Well, I think there are problems with the public option as it's being envisioned. If you look at what they're talking about, for instance, in the Senate Finance Committee, it really isn't a very strong public option at all. We'll have to see what comes out in their ultimate legislation. I do think that the public option that is in the House bill is quite worthwhile. There is the risk that Dr. Wohlhandler mentions that the public option will pick up sicker patients, and that is a real problem, and there are ways to try and adjust for that, but they're certainly not perfect. But if you believe that the private insurance industry is not going to abide by the regulations 100% that we set up for them, it's crucially important to have a safe harbor for Americans to go that is non-for-profit, that is national and available on comparable terms around the country, and that is not interested in enrolling only healthy people. And enacting a public option would do that.
Let's go to Kate in Topsfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great show. I just wanted to comment, really. My husband and I are small-time mom-and-pop business owners in retail.
Mm-hmm.
We've been getting crushed by the economy for years. We have laid off a full-time worker 4 years ago because of the economic downturn. We could not afford her health insurance anymore. We have a plan with Tufts Insurance. We just had to reduce our own health insurance plan with Tufts so we could save $3,000 a year. We are paying $13,500 a year for a family of four, a healthy family of four, for insurance here. We now have what I consider rationed care, because we are no longer allowed to get an annual eye checkup, even though three out of the four of us wear glasses. When my husband and I go to see our primary care physician, we always have to see a nurse practitioner first, long before we get to see a doctor.
So do you see help on the way in the Obama reform push, Kate, or not?
I absolutely see help on the way. There has to be a public policy. I can tell you right now, my husband and I would jump ship just to stick it to the insurance companies because we feel that they are just sticking it to us.
Kate, let us pick it up. Steffi Wohlhandler, do you see help on the way for Kate and her husband, small business people, in what's coming out of Washington?
Oh, absolutely not. They're living in the state of Massachusetts, which already has a plan like they're proposing in Washington. If the public plan option was this kinder, gentler force that enrolled all the sick people, the premiums are going to go through the roof because the public plan option they're proposing is not going to be subsidized. It has to pay for all of the care out of premiums, so it can't go around enrolling all the people in the chemotherapy suites and all the people with multiple sclerosis and people having trouble elsewhere. Medicare could. Medicare enrolls everyone. It doesn't compete. And then you can get care for everyone. But to have a public plan and make it compete with private is not going to work. You know, there's public plan options in place. In other places, there's a public plan option in the state of Maine. You haven't heard of it because it's not a game changer. Healthcare is still expensive in Maine. There's still uninsured people. There was a public plan option in Tennessee in the 10 care program. It went out of business after a year. There's a public plan option in Minnesota. And there's actually a form of public plan option here in the state of Massachusetts. Network Health, which anyone earning less than 300% of poverty can enroll in. Again, you haven't heard of it because it's not a game changer. It didn't change anything to have a public plan option in there.
Jonathan, you hear Kate's distress, and she's not alone. $13,500 and still feels poorly covered. Okay, here's an American small business person. Do you see relief on the way in the Obama reform push or not?
Yes, I do. Most of the uninsured are concentrated in our small businesses.
But she's insured,
really
can't afford it, and doesn't like what she's getting.
Right. Well, under the Obama plan, we shouldn't say the Obama plan, but the principles he supports, and under the House bill, for example, as well as the Senate legislation, small businesses would get a credit, a tax credit, to help them afford insurance. Small businesses and their workers would also have access to this insurance exchange, which would include the regulated private plans and the public option. And again, it would depend, as we've said before, crucially on what the subsidies are. But I believe that many folks who are in small businesses right now would gain insurance under this plan that would be much more affordable for them.
Let's go to Charlie in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm very sympathetic to Dr. Wohlhandler's ideas about a single-payer system, but at the same time, I am very impressed by Mr. Overlander's ideas about the realism, whether that's really a realistic option for us given the political climate that we're living in. And I'm wondering, particularly from Dr. Wohlhandler, how she would see that realistically coming about. And is it really the case that anything short of a single-payer system would be worse than nothing, worse than the status quo?
Dr. Wohlhandler?
We'd have to see the details before we said it was worse than the status quo. But what we do know is that the Massachusetts plan, which is what they're copying, is no solution. You know, there's polls showing that two-thirds of the American people endorse the idea of Medicare for all. Two-thirds of American physicians support the idea of national health insurance. So what does it mean when Nancy Pelosi or Max Baucus or President Obama says it's not politically feasible? What it means is the private insurance industry has weighed in and said that they're not going to allow it. The American people want it. Doctors say they want it. We really need to change the concept of what's politically feasible. And frankly, what the president's proposing is it not in economic reality. It's not economically feasible. It's not possible. It sounded great on TV last night, but $100 billion is not going to give everybody, even $100 billion a year is not going to give everybody health coverage in this country if you leave the private insurance industry in the middle. It's not going to happen, and he did a great job in telling us what the problem was, but what Mr. Obama said about the solution is actually simply not true.
But so you would seriously say stay right where we are rather than do what the president's pushing for? And with what strategy in mind by that? That the pain will grow and maybe 4 years from now, 8 years from now, 20 years from now will change?
Well, we could do some smaller things. We could put more money into primary care. We could give some money to neighborhood health centers. But we actually need our political leaders to push for single payer. That's the only thing that's going to solve this problem. I feel a little bit like people saying, well, the patient has breast cancer. We can't get her surgery. Should we give her aspirin or Tylenol? Actually, it's an irrelevant debate. What Obama's putting out on the table won't solve the problems of middle-income people. It won't cover all the uninsured. And the very similar plan in Massachusetts has not done the job.
Jonathan, I'll come to you on that. Let me go first to Harlan, Iowa, and Josh. Josh, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great topic today. All right. Several of the problems I've seen with socialized medicine in other countries around us, Canada, UK, around the world, is that there is a tremendous problem with an unemployment rate. Countries like that have unemployments that we have right now, 8, 9, 10%. In addition, with the problems having to do with the waits, the 8 months of waiting to get checked for migraines, you know, tremendous waits having all of the Americans waiting on this health care plan. And I don't foresee that there is a way for the government to properly manage a health care plan that can, with that amount of people on it.
Our time is short, but let us pick it up, Josh, and thank you for your call. Now, on unemployment, of course, we've got pretty nasty unemployment ourselves right now. Let's put that aside for a moment and look at this issue of access. The president was asked about this last night, and I'll come to you on this, Jonathan. But Steve Kaufman from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, where the president is today, said, he asked the president, can you guarantee that this legislation will lock in and say the government will never deny any services, that's going to be decided by the doctor and the patient, and the government will not deny any coverage? There was a long preamble in the president's response, and then he came to this answer.
Can I guarantee that there are going to be no changes in the healthcare delivery system? No. The whole point of this is to try to encourage changes that work for the American people and make them healthier. Now, the government already is making some of these decisions. More importantly, insurance companies right now are making those decisions. And part of what we want to do is to make sure that those decisions are being made by doctors and medical experts based on evidence, based on what works.
The president last night. Now, Jonathan Overlander, it's very easy for a lot of things to get muddled up here, and I want to try not to do that. I mean, Steffi Wohlhandler would say what's being proposed is not socialized enough in a way. But you hear a caller from Iowa expressing the concern that this is going to be socialized medicine and what's on the table now will leave Americans cut off from the care they might want when they need it. What do you say to that concern?
First of all, this is not socialized medicine. In contrast to what Congressman Burgess said earlier, the government is not going to take over the healthcare system. Under the legislation before both the House and the Senate, private insurance would remain a very big component of the healthcare system. So it's just not true that the government would take over the system. Secondly, if you look at other countries and, you know, single payer is one model, a lot of European countries have a very different model than Canada, even though they cover everyone. And in many of those countries, places like France and Germany, waiting lists really aren't an issue. And even in Canada for emergency care, Canadians get very timely emergency care. It's certainly not a perfect system, but we should never forget that we have about 50 million Americans that aren't getting on any waiting list in this country because they don't have insurance. And I think to suggest that somehow investing in primary care is a bigger step forward than insuring two-thirds, three-quarters, or whatever it is of Americans who are uninsured right now is really a sort of self-defeating and absurd argument.
The Congressional Budget Office said last week they were concerned that what's emerging will not be affordable. Do they have that wrong? Do you see a dynamic here that would lead us to the better place in cost terms, economic terms that the president described last night?
There's no doubt that paying for this is the biggest challenge, and we have to separate two issues. One is, can the proposal be paid for over the next decade in a way that does not increase the federal deficit? And there, I think the answer is clear. It can be, and I think Congress eventually will produce a plan that won't increase the deficit. The second question, which is really what CBO is concerned with, is can we bend the long-term cost curve in medical care? Is there something in the legislation that will really have a dramatic effect on rising health care costs over the next decade or two? And in that respect, I am concerned that the cost control measures that we have in the bill are not strong enough.
Not strong enough yet. Steffi Wohlhandler, you're going to be campaigning against this and for nothing?
We aren't campaigning against it, but as a physician, I have to tell you, it's not going to work. Getting people insurance is not the same thing as getting them access. And in this state of Massachusetts, where we did this kind of plan, the state poured money into the plan, over $1 billion a year, got people insured, but they still don't have access to care.
Well, a big push going on right now, but I guess you'd have to say the deal not done yet. It's going to be amazing to watch over the next couple of months. Huge stakes for this country and the health care of every American. Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
You're very welcome.
And Jonathan Oberlander from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you very much, Jonathan, for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.